Eight Nights, copyright 2013 by John Speed.
Night 7. And that's the 7th candle. We've nearly come to the end of this celebration, of this time to remember our forefathers and their roller coaster relationship with their God. This time that our forebears, who had lived through horror and wonder 2,200 years ago, set aside for themselves and the generations to come together and light lights with their family and friends and remember the great miracle every year forever. I'm glad you invited me in, my unseen friends. I thank you for the honor of sharing this time with you. Tomorrow, the miracle. Tonight, the bummer. Tonight, when we get done, believe me, we'll all want a drink. Some of you will be lucky enough to get one. Oh, Jason, what a glorious fool you were. You thought you were dealing with a megalomaniac. How could you know that you were dealing with evil incarnate? You know, you knew, I'm sure, that it would be a tough transition. I can just imagine the look on your brother's face when you told him to strip off all his clothes and then you picked them up and put them on. And the look... Oh, I should mention this. I should mention that the high priest got installed by wearing the ceremonial clothing of the former high priest in the tabernacle for a full day and night. In case you've forgotten about the ceremonial garb of the high priest, I mentioned this in the middle of night 2. And I can just imagine the look of the 70 members of the Council of Elders in the room of hewn stone when you told them to pack up and... Wait a minute, I've lost my place. Oh, here we go. And I can imagine the look on the faces of the 70 members of the Council of Elders in the room of hewn stone when you told them to pack up and go home and marched in a whole new hand-picked council and not a priest or Pharisee in the lot. And the faces of the chief priests when you told them you were going to knock down the back wall of the temple and build a gymnasium there. And the faces of the keepers of the temple treasury when you told them to rustle up 360 talents of pure silver for delivery to the king's palace. And the faces of the people of Jerusalem when they heard you were going to decree that henceforth and forever their city would be called Antioch. Well, you knew there'd be some tough days. You knew there'd be some grumbling, fistfights even. Handy to have command of that scary, nasty garrison to maintain order when the looting started. You made it clear pretty quick who was boss. Days passed, weeks, months. Slowly people got used to you. You did your job. You wore the robes, sprinkled the blood, waved your arms at the appropriate times, nodded solemnly at the concerns of the Sadducees and Pharisees and scribes, and you didn't make any sudden disturbing moves. People expected you to jail or exile your brother Onias, the former high priest, but you mercifully allowed him to retire quietly to the country, and that won you some goodwill. Eventually the dust settled. Eventually people realized the upside of the downside. You were in charge. You, a Jew, a high priest, ruled Judea. It was almost the same as when Israel had a king. Instead of Israel, Antioch. Instead of a king, a high priest. But almost the same. Pretty darn close, actually. Jerusalem began to admire you. Go ahead and get puffed up, Jason. You like Greek, right? Look up the word hubris. Actually, after the dust settled, things went along fairly well. Maybe better than anyone expected for the next 3 or 4 years. It got a lot tougher for the country Jews, however. Jason's new council of elders was made up of Jerusalem Jews, merchants mostly, and all of them, oddly enough, agreed that taxes had to be reduced for the suffering merchants of Jerusalem, but should be raised for the privileged farmers and herders of the countryside, who were basically freeloading off the wealth of the city. Without the benefit of all the merchants' hard work, after all, where would those country folk be? Where would they sell their goods? Time for those freeloaders to pay their fair share, which turned out to be two or three times the share paid by the merchants. When the gymnasium was complete, Antiochus visited Jerusalem, or that is Antioch. Jason rounded up everybody, and I mean everybody, and showed him a good time. The royal full treatment, parades, golden crowns, honors, the works. Antiochus clapped Jason on the back and said they were best friends forever, so pleased with his bright idea of creating a polis that he went home with a big grin on his face and started thinking about making a whole bunch more throughout his whole kingdom. Yes, everything was going well for Jason, until a bright young boy named Menelaus took a look at Jason's playbook and asked to have a chat with Antiochus himself. Menelaus went to Antiochus Epiphanes, the god-king of the Seleucids, with a deal quite similar to Jason's, only shorter. Antiochus should fire Jason and make Menelaus the high priest instead. Menelaus would pay triple the current tribute to Antiochus. 1,080 talents of silver every year. That's almost 65,000 pounds. That's more than 16 automobiles, or a stack of American silver dollars 28 miles tall. The space shuttle would need to swerve around that stack. Anyway, I'm guessing Antiochus about leaped over the table to shake Menelaus's hand on that deal. Jason was too smart to wait around. As soon as he dropped his high priest robes at Menelaus's feet, he ran for the hills. 1,080 talents is a boatload of silver. Frankly, just about all the temple's cash. It pretty much cleaned out the treasury. When the Jews saw the cartload after cartload of silver, their silver, driving down Temple Street, driving off to Antiochus, there were riots. Standard, modern-day style riots, complete with looting. It took a lot of broken bones and a few spears through a few hearts before things calmed down. Menelaus was not well-liked. Up until that time, things had been going pretty well. The gymnasium in the rear of the temple was a great big hit. People were flocking to the gymnasium every day, making it a regular part of their daily routine. Warm Greek baths. Well, they beat cold ritual mikvahs any day. Foreskin stretching became more and more popular. Nobody was bothering to stand around to watch the boring sacrifices anymore. The gymnasium was so much more fun than watching dead burning animals. The calisthenics and competitions were so enjoyable that even temple priests joined in. In fact, sometimes the temple proceedings had to wait until they could round up enough priests to come back from their games at the gymnasium. A year passed, and the second tribute of 1,080 talents of silver came due, and the temple treasury just didn't have it, not in cash at least. Now, I've been speaking about the temple treasury, and I've meant the repository of its cash, that is, the coins involved in its banking. But it held more wealth than that. Over many years, the temple had gotten love gifts of great value that weren't in coin. Things like that basket of golden tumors from the Philistines, for example. And more items of value, like gold chains or necklaces or crowns, that sort of thing. I call them love gifts because these are the sort of things that people gave out of a sense of gratitude or affection. Things that mattered to them. Gifts from the heart. The temple had a lot of these sorts of things, and they really didn't know what the hell to do with them. You couldn't just hang a necklace from a pushpin on a wall or something, so they just squirreled them away. If push came to shove, the keepers of the treasury reasoned they could always sell them, but until that time came, they had rooms full of beautiful, valuable, and not very liquid objects. Well, on the day the second payment of talents came due, push had definitely come to shove. Menelaus ransacked the love gifts. Naturally, this did not go over well with some of the temple priests. It was one thing to take the banking profits. After all, maybe the temple shouldn't have been involved in banking at all, but those gifts of love given by the faithful to their Lord, shouldn't those at the very least be sacrosanct? Those troubled priests got word to Ananias, the first deposed high priest who was living in a nearby town. Ananias didn't like it. He raced to Jerusalem with a bunch of angry Jews behind him and confronted Menelaus. One of Menelaus's men figured the simplest response was to kill Ananias. Well, that was kind of rude, and it was the kind of act that makes the ugliness of the situation all too obvious. It's like when the redneck sheriffs turn their fire hoses and their ferocious dogs on the little black kids trying to go to school, or when the whole world sees the pictures of prisoners wearing panties on their heads at Abu Ghraib. Suddenly the ugliness is just too obvious. Nobody feels good anymore. You just can't kill a high priest in cold blood. A pall fell on Jerusalem. Menelaus felt it and left town. Antiochus started issuing decrees. He sent someone to execute the murderer. He might have thought that would have calmed things down. It only made matters worse. Everybody realized that Menelaus was just Antiochus's puppet. Not even much of a puppet when you came down to it. He was just the guy who was ransacking the love gifts. Antiochus also decreed that a statue of himself as Zeus was to be placed at the front of the gymnasium, complete with altar, and that sacrifices were to be made there daily. Sacrifices to Zeus meant pigs. Antiochus had this notion that the problem with the Jews was that they didn't realize who the hell they really should be worshiping, meaning him. He thought a big-ass statue and some pig sacrifices would make that easier for the Jews to understand. So far as money went, Antiochus was raking it in. Now, megalomaniac kings follow one of two courses when they get flush. Either they build big monuments to themselves, or they amass big honking armies to attack their enemies. And Antiochus was taking the second option. About this time, things were getting squirrely with the Ptolemies. Their king had died, and the new heir was underage, and there was a big argument over the succession. The Ptolemies managed to reach a very dicey compromise, and Antiochus got invited to the coronation. He bought himself the biggest, most well-equipped army on the face of the earth, and he marched it down to Egypt, ostensibly to celebrate the young king's coronation. In fact, to depose him. Since he'd enjoyed such a warm reception before, and since he wanted to show the Jews who was boss, Antiochus decided to pass through Jerusalem on his way to Egypt. Menelaus returned from his self-imposed exile. Somehow, he managed to gather up enough Jews to cheer as Antiochus passed through the city. Menelaus took Antiochus through the temple to the gymnasium and showed off his brand new big-ass statue of Zeus that looked just like, of all people, Antiochus. The two of them stood there together and watched Antiochus's Greek priests sacrifice a few pigs to the god king. The locals cheered for all they were worth. Antiochus probably didn't see the soldiers standing behind them, threatening them with swords just to be sure they showed sufficient enthusiasm. And then the sacred pulled pork barbecue was passed around. Anybody brave enough to eat some got gold stars from Menelaus. While the Ptolemies were squabbling over the succession, another power was just beginning to flex its muscles in the world, Rome. The Ptolemies understood that their country was in danger from the Seleucids, and that the succession dispute had weakened them, and they looked to the growing might of Rome for an alliance, which, as it turned out, could not have come at a better time. In Gaza, north of Egypt, a single Roman general rode out alone to the desert and met Antiochus and his vast army. He told him that he had been sent by the Roman Senate with a message for Antiochus. If Antiochus attacked the Ptolemies, the message said, Rome would destroy the Seleucids. The general asked what answer he should give to the Senate. Antiochus said he would think about it. With that, the general drew a line in the sand in a circle around the spot where Antiochus stood. Yes, this is the line in the sand. Pray do not step outside that line before I have heard your reply, the general said. And by the way, if you ever find yourself in a similar situation, pay attention to the smooth moves of that solitary Roman general. He went alone, and that meant he totally dominated. Antiochus had his whole honking army, 50 or 100,000 men, cavalry, chariots, even war elephants for Pete's sake, and the general faced them down all by himself. If he'd taken along a dozen Roman soldiers, or 100, or even a few thousand, Antiochus would have done the math and figured, hell, I can take him. Antiochus would have felt obliged to take him. But alone? How do you deal with that? It's just too intimidating for words. It's just honking brilliant. Nice going, solitary Roman general. Anyway, there was the general, and there was Antiochus, and there was the lion in the sand. Antiochus gave some thought to his reply before he stepped outside the circle. And then the little coward turned tail and ran. Meanwhile in Jerusalem. Now Maccabees Book 1 and Maccabees Book 2 tell parallel versions of what happened. Maccabees 1 is a very matter-of-fact. Maccabees 2 sets the stage. For 40 days before the Egyptian invasion, the second book tells us, the sky was filled with apparitions of golden horsemen charging through the air with lances and drawn swords and, oh hell, this is worth quoting, and troops of horsemen drawn up and attacks and counterattacks made on this side and that, brandishing of shields, massing of spears, hurling of missiles, the flash of golden trappings and armor of all sorts. That's all in the sky, mind you. And I like this part too, which is quite wistful and charming. Therefore, all men prayed that the apparitions might prove to be a good omen. As if. The story of Antiochus and the general that reached Jerusalem, like the mixed-up finish at the end of a game of telephone, was slightly different than the story I just told you, slightly. The story that reached Jerusalem was that Antiochus was dead. Cue the confetti, the ticker tape parade, the dancing in the streets, and while you're at it, cue Jason. Remember Jason, the former but not dead high priest, who had been gathering 1,000 followers just outside of town? Jason and his men staged a triumphant return into Jerusalem. The Jews were jubilant. They forgot all the crap they'd endured while Jason was high priest. All they remembered now was that he wasn't Menelaus. While they were carrying Jason around town on their shoulders, Menelaus scurried out of town while the getting was good. Remember that messages in those days only traveled as fast as the people who carried them. So within a few hours of Jason's return and Menelaus' flight, who showed up at Jerusalem's gate but Antiochus himself? When he saw the Jews rejoicing over his supposed death, Antiochus flew into a rage. He ordered his army to kill everyone. Everyone and anyone they could find. And then to hunt down and kill everyone and anyone that was hiding. And they did. Men, women, children, infants, 40,000 Jews, 40,000 defenseless Jews killed in a few hours. They didn't die gloriously. They didn't die for their country. They didn't die in an earthquake or a fire or a tsunami. They didn't even die because they killed Christ or because they were racially inferior. Those 40,000 defenseless Jews died because a fucking psychopath was having a bad day. Even Hitler's worst death camp never killed 40,000 Jews in a single day. Now, at this point, I want to tell you how Antiochus died. It's not part of the story. I wish with all my heart that the Jews had killed him, but his death happened while he was on his way to put down a rebellion of Persians. Nevertheless, I want you to know how he died right this minute. Antiochus got a horrifically terrible disease. He was infested with parasites that ate through his organs and chewed through his gut until his belly burst open and thousands of white carnivorous worms spilled out. It was a painful, living hell of a death, and it was a death that was way too good for Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, I guess the slaughter stopped before everyone was killed. I guess the soldiers got worn out or just sick to their stomach, something. Anyway, it turns out there were still some Jews left the next day. These were Jerusalem Jews. Jews that had adopted the Greek culture, the language, the hair, the shaving, the clothing, the restored foreskins. Perhaps because they had tried to embrace civilized behavior, Antiochus took what I suppose in his mind passed for pity. In the midst of city streets still littered with corpses of their brothers and sisters, Antiochus gave those Jews a choice: death. Or drop their stupid ways and follow his new decrees. No more Sabbaths. No more sacrifices. No more mikvahs. No more circumcisions. No more Torahs. In fact, all copies of the Torahs were to be burned. The temple was to be rededicated entirely to the worship of Zeus, in other words, to Antiochus. The festivals of the law were to be done away with. No Passover, no Sukkot, no Yom Kippur. In their place, Olympic Games. And that whole no pork thing, that had to go. "Sounds good to us," said the Jerusalem Jews, standing in the blood of their relatives. "Where do we sign?" Antiochus went back home, but he left a big chunk of his army behind with instructions on how to proceed. The soldiers went through Jerusalem, street by street, house by house, person by person. They looked for circumcised children. These they killed, along with their mothers. If the children were small enough, they were tied still living around their mothers' necks, and both were thrown from the temple walls. The houses were tossed to find copies of the Torah. If these were found, the scrolls and the occupants were burned. Naturally, a lot of copies of the Torahs just got found lying in the street. Finally, the pork test. Every person, every single one, had to eat pork. It was the proof of compliance. Eat pork or die. So Menelaus eventually crept back into town, and Antiochus put him back in charge. Who knows why? Supposedly more money changed hands, but heaven only knows where it came from. Back in charge meant that the high priest of the Jews was now the high priest of Antiochus as Olympian Zeus. Menelaus soon had the priests of the temple making sacrifices to Zeus instead of Hashem. The gymnasium changed from an adjunct to the center of the temple's activity. The Jews walked past the tabernacle without looking up. At the temple now, pigs were burned in addition to sheep, and Zeus preferred pigs. Menelaus imported as many as he could to keep the god happy and encouraged the Jewish farmers around the city to start raising pigs. Pork quickly became the preferred meat of Jerusalem. After a few months, when he saw the high priest bowing to the statue of Olympian Zeus and the chief priests offering sacrifices of swine at the altar of the god, when he saw the former Jews of Jerusalem singing hymns to Zeus and kneeling at the statue's feet and eating pork still hot from the altar, when he felt confident that worship of the Jewish God had been replaced with worship of himself as Zeus, Antiochus gathered up his men and marched them back to Jerusalem, to his palace in Antioch. He left behind a garrison of soldiers at the temple citadel, and orders that Menelaus send them through the rest of Israel or Judea or Antioch or whatever they were calling it in these days, and rid the world of Jews forever. There was no need for Jews to die. They just needed to cease to exist. They could stop being Jews, just as their kinsmen in Jerusalem had done. The choice was up to them. The garrison was there to draw a line in the sand around them and wait for their reply. Judea covered a lot of territory, and the garrison was small, so it took some time. They rode from village to village, rounded everybody up, burned all the tourists they could find, lined up the Jews at sword point, brought out the pork. A few old souls would refuse to eat and die, but not many. A few miles to the northwest of Jerusalem was a village called Modin. At this point, the soldiers making the rounds had gotten used to the drill. They burned the Torahs just like always, lined up the villagers for the pork like always. Now, this town had as its rabbi an old man. We don't know his name. And it also had its country priest, a man named Mattathias. The rabbi wouldn't eat the pork. He began to weep. Some of the villagers loved him and took him aside. Someone slipped him a piece of chicken and told him to eat that instead. Just pretend to eat the pork. The rabbi agreed, but when the time came, he was overcome again and could not. One of the villagers had enough. "It's no big thing," he shouted. And he stepped in front of the rabbi and took a piece of pork to demonstrate. And Mattathias, who'd been watching this scene, lost it. He leaped up, struck that villager across the head with his staff, and killed him. "Let everyone who has zeal for the Torah and who stands by the covenant follow me," shouted Mattathias. One of those great lines that probably never got shouted. Anyway, they followed. I guess they killed or somehow overcame the soldiers, and the whole village took to the hills. And this was the start of the Great Rebellion. So while Jerusalem continued to worship Zeus and the countryside of Judea, more and more villagers packed up and took to the hills. Mattathias' rebellion for many months consisted of little more than finding ways to hide from the small garrison of Jerusalem. Remember, the villagers were mostly herders and farmers familiar with their area and the rugged hill country of Judea. The soldiers were foreign mercenaries with no clue at all. They had a hard enough job finding a village that was where it was supposed to be. Trekking around the wilderness looking for a bunch of people hiding behind rocks was not in their job description. I'm personally a big believer in stable situations. I think that people work to find ways to make situations stable, even if the solution is unpleasant. This situation, however, running around in the wilderness with no end in sight, is unstable both for the Jews and the soldiers, and it's about to get a little more unstable, and then very unstable. Let's take a look at the current instability. First, you got these villagers uprooted. They're used to houses, beds, wells, you get my drift. And they're living now in the open. They're like their ancestors in the Sinai. Some probably have brought along their sheep. Some probably have brought a few provisions. There's food maybe, but not much. Shelter maybe, some. When it's cold and rainy, your children get sick. The hills have lots of caves though, so that's where people end up spending time. Lots of worry, constant worry. Nobody knows what's safe. Is moving better than staying put? Yet scared people feel compelled to move. You get the idea. You wouldn't want to be one of those villagers on the run. Jerusalem, however, just lost its supply chain. Everything Jerusalem eats comes from the villagers, who are now running in the wilderness. The city probably has some storehouses, but just like the villagers are taking inventory and worrying about how many more meals they can count on, so are the Jews of Jerusalem. The garrison that is supposed to be dealing with the Great Rebellion is going to be needed in Jerusalem, too, because food riots aren't far away. As for the garrison, things have gotten unstable for them as well. They signed up to be real soldiers, assigned to the citadel to defend the temple, so they thought, from attack by the Ptolemies. And now they're throwing mothers and babies from the temple walls and feeding pork to weeping rabbis and chasing farmers through the hills. What are they supposed to do with a farm girl when they find her anyway? Rape her? Run her through with the heart? Find a scrap of ham and force her to eat it? So here's the first little wild card. The Hasids. Nobody really knows who they are, but both books of Maccabees mention that a group called the Hasids joined up with a rebellion. After that, the rebellion began to change. A lot of scholars think that the Hasids were an early version of a later group of Jews called the Essenes, and we know a lot about them. They were an extremely devoted and faithful group of Jews, mostly males, who joined together, sold their possessions, pooled the proceeds, and ate meals in common, bunked together, and followed rigorous hygiene practices. They were huge believers in a messianic apocalypse with beliefs that were not a lot different from many of our modern end-time Christians. Anyway, after meeting the Hasids, the rebellion changed. The rebels didn't just flee. They attacked. I don't know why it was such a novel idea to pick off some of the soldiers when they came hunting for the rebels, but the notion only seemed to catch on when the Hasids showed up. As the rebels started to kill soldiers, things got unstable enough that Antiochus got wind of it. So he started by sending a couple of thousand troops to Judea. Now, I've told you before how troops fought battles. Things hadn't changed that much from the time of David and Saul. Big armies lining up for big battles. This big Seleucid army got down there, but there wasn't any big rebel army lined up against them. But it turned out this first attack came out rather well for the rebels. They were led by the third of Mattathias' five sons, a young man named Judas, who has since become known as Maccabee, the Hammer. Judas Maccabee's idea was for the rebels to hide in the hills surrounding the Seleucid camp and attack by night. This, apparently, was very poor form, and the Seleucids did not know what hit them. Judas and the rebels set fire to the Seleucid tents, stole a ton of armor, weapons, horses, and best of all, food, killed a bunch of soldiers, and ran away before the sun came up. Judas was a great big hero. The rebels started calling themselves the Hammers, or as they've come to be known, the Maccabees. The Maccabees had just beaten a well-equipped army with sticks and rocks and slings and crappy farmers' weapons, and now they had swords and spears and shields. The Seleucids that survived came after them. Judas's basic plan stayed the same, fight like hell as you run away. It was a pretty good plan. It confused hell out of the Seleucids. They were used to battles with lines and flanks and glorious charges and the like. They weren't used to chasing Jews and dying. But Judas's tactic had a great big flaw, which the Seleucids discovered one Sabbath day. On the Sabbath, these faithful noble Jews would huddle together in caves and observe the Mosaic law of Sabbath rest. That meant doing nothing. Nothing. Not even defending themselves or running away. And if the Seleucids stumbled onto one of those caves, here's what happened. The Seleucids gathered piles of wood and set it in the mouth of the cave, and the Jews just sat and watched. And then the Seleucids set the wood on fire and burned the Jews alive. The next day, when Mattathias heard this news, he gave the order that the Jews were to violate the Sabbath and fight back. "For what value has the Sabbath," he said, "if there is no one left to observe it?" And it was these words, my friends, that made me decide to tell this story. Crappy non-Jew that I am, unworthy vessel that I am, for what value has this miracle? and the thousand pairs of hands that have passed this light to me if the story is forgotten. I've gotten tired of waiting for somebody good to tell it. You're just going to have to put up with me. So the Maccabees kept fighting as they ran away, even on the Sabbath, and the Seleucids, to their surprise, kept dying. It's like they just the hell couldn't figure out what was happening. They were supposed to win, for Pete's sake. The Jews were supposed to die. Antiochus set another army, a bigger one, 6,000 men this time. Damn if Judas didn't pull basically the same exact stunt, surprise night raid, with exactly the same result, except this time practically all the Seleucid soldiers were killed, and the Seleucids that didn't die were even more surprised. Around this time, Mattathias died, and he surprised his eldest son, Johann, by making Judas the leader of the rebels. Word of the Maccabees' success had spread throughout the country, and practically every Jew that wasn't in Jerusalem had left his village to join the rebels, which made the rebels into sitting ducks. Antiochus stopped farting around. He sent a really large army south this time, 25,000 men or more. He sent word to Jerusalem that he was going to capture all the rebels and sell them as slaves, and he was going to do what the Babylonians had done, raise the city. Antiochus's heralds cried that Jerusalem would be a graveyard. If the faithful Zeus-worshipping Jews would flee the city, head north, and join the king, only then would they be spared the rebels' fate of slavery or death. They ran like rats. The massive Seleucid force marched toward the rebel encampment. Judas gave his men, according to the books of Maccabees, the traditional rebel leader's inspiring speech before the enormous conflict. You could probably write it yourself if you've seen Braveheart or Henry V, so I won't bore you, but I do love one line Judas spoke. What can't Hashem accomplish? I do so love that line. And it wasn't just that massive army heading south, following right behind hundreds of slave traders with empty slave wagons and empty shackles and empty chains at the ready with lots of coin, too. Antiochus had told them there'd be plenty of slaves to buy wholesale. This time, the Seleucids were ready for the Maccabees' surprise attack by dark. Judas surprised them anyway by attacking with a full frontal assault in broad daylight, miles from where the Seleucids expected. Judas wiped them out, every last one of them. Then he took all their armor and their weapons and their horses, and he also took all the money the slave traders had brought. By the way, the Maccabees didn't know it, but why Antiochus wasn't leading that army that day was that trouble I'd mentioned earlier, that trouble he was having with those Persian rebels. The Jews didn't know it, but right now, Antiochus was dead too. His wormy guts were spilled all over the ground someplace outside Qum. I told you tonight was going to be a bummer, but right now it's not. Right now, the good guys have triumphed. Antiochus is dead. Let's let the Maccabees enjoy that victory. You enjoy it too. After the feasting and the dancing and the slapping each other on the back and agreeing that they were all great heroes, somebody must have suggested that they should all go to Jerusalem. I can imagine the moment. After things had gotten quiet and everyone was staring at the fire, a quiet voice reciting an old poem. As the navel is the center of the human body, so is Judea the navel of the world, situated in the center of the world, and Jerusalem in the center of Judea, and Mount Zion in the center of Jerusalem, and in the center, the peak of the mount, the temple. and the tabernacle in the center of the temple, and the ark in the center of the tabernacle, placed on the stone from which the world was founded. In the holiest of cities, in the holiest of places, on Yom Kippur, the holiest of days, the high priest would venture into the Holy of Holies and see the ark resting on the mercy seat on that day each year. The high priest would sprinkle the ark with the blood of the scapegoat to atone for all the sins of all the Jews and say the holiest of names, the hidden name of the Lord. And then he would see in the mist that rose above the ark the Lord's very face. And then Jerusalem would seem so very precious again. After years of fleeing through the hills to see Jerusalem once more, to see the tabernacle, to hear the choir sing the psalms, so far and now so near, I'm sure that grown men wept. By the end of the evening, the Maccabees had probably started calling their homeland Israel again after their glorious victory and everything, so we'll do the same. It will be nice to use that simple name again. Anyway, most of the country folk of Israel now lived in that encampment, and a lot of them probably just wanted to get back to their lives. A lot of them hadn't seen their homes in a long, long time. 3 years had passed between the day Mattathias killed that show-off in Modiin and Judas's astonishing victory over the Seleucid army. Those country Jews were anxious to return, and they'd also sort of dreaded what they would find. When the garrison soldiers found a village empty because the villagers had joined the rebels, a lot of times they just torched the empty houses. And even if they hadn't, the fields would be fallow and overrun with weeds. Herders had long ago eaten all their flocks. It would be a long time before the rebels would recover. Judas shared the slaver's coin with the rebels who went home. That would help a little. Even so, glad as they were to go home, the more they thought about it, the more they could foresee the mess that they would find there. It would be a long, dreary road. Within a day or two, the rebel camp had dwindled to a tenth of its size. Those who remained were people who maybe had no home to go to, or had a reason why Jerusalem was more important to see first. The Maccabees began the trek to Jerusalem. Along the road, they saw the hurt the Seleucids had done, villages burned, bodies left to rot in the sun. The old King's Road, now left untended, washed out in places, pitted and scarred in others, inns empty, wells run dry, houses by the roadside falling down, no sound of children playing, no sound of birds but carrion crows, the olive and fig trees stripped of fruit, the hillside grasses burned. Finally, the city walls, the sight that once had lifted their hearts, now filled them with foreboding. One of the city gates lay broken on the ground. The other flapped slowly as if pushed by an unseen hand. The ruins of David's palace, left as a kind of sacred memory after the Babylonians had their way, could scarcely be seen. It was so overrun with weeds. Ahead of them, Temple Street, once so glorious and fine, looked like a cyclone had torn through, broken furniture and crockery strewn across the cobblestones, hungry dogs picking through garbage, and pigs, which many of the Jews had never seen before, fighting the dogs for scraps. No sound. That was the strangest thing. No sound. Just the shuffling of their own footsteps, the rattle of their cartwheels threading through the rubble. At the top of Mount Zion, they could scarcely bear to enter the temple gates. They looked down the hill at the empty houses, the empty streets. Everyone had fled, terrified by Antiochus's warning. Maybe someone had tried to lock the temple. The great wood gates were just ajar, just open enough for a man to pass, and a lock hung from a broken chain. They pushed the gates a little wider. The sun was lowering, just touching the edge of the tall temple walls. The arcade entrance to the courtyard was a chaos, like Temple Street, tables, chairs tossed every which way. Judas had been hanging back, but now he had to take the lead. No one else had the courage. At the grand entrance to the courtyard, even he could not go on. I don't know where to start. With the bushes that were growing through the false floor before the tabernacle, with the altar cast down like a child's tower of pebbles, the great bowl of bronze upended, took all their strength to go on, and with every step they saw more horror. Around the brass bowl of the altar burnt fragments of the Torah, turds on the steps of the tabernacle, writing on the walls, vile words written in something brown. It didn't matter if it was blood or shit. They knew the law forbid them from entering the tabernacle, but they no longer cared. Their broken hearts wouldn't let them stand outside. Blankets and pillows strewn around the floor. It didn't take much imagination. The menorah smashed, the table for showbread folded like someone had jumped on it. Then they saw it. On the empty space where the ark had been, something so vile that Judas gagged. Others vomited. Finally, someone managed to find the strength to cover it with a blanket. They stumbled from the tabernacle, fell to their knees, and wept. They stopped weeping, finally, because they had no more tears to shed. That's it.